welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
I tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
Ah, you know.
But there's a sign upon your door.
Uh-huh.
Gone fishing.
I'm real gone, man.
You ain't working anymore.
Could be.
Gone fishing in Go-Go, but Bing and Louie probably prefer fresh ones. Tonight we have a preference for fishes of great age, 450 million years or so. That's when they're not quite so smelly. Good evening. Robin Williams with In Conversation, and the odd thing about the fish I'm offering you is that they're swimming in stone, for that's the title of Dr. John Long's new book. I nearly said latest book, but I'm not sure that that's right, because like his famous fellow fossil cousin Tim Flannery, John Long writes an incredible number of books, from science stories to science fiction, and even cheery tales for children. He's also just published two highly significant papers in leading journals such as Nature, on lost lions and the nullarbor, or on those fish. John Long, you found the fish at Go-Go, didn't you? Where's that?
Go-Go is in the far north of Australia, up around the Kimberley district. We're looking at probably 300 kilometres inland from Derby, what is part of the mixing zone between the Great Sandy Desert to the south and the true Kimberley to the north. 400 million years ago, it was an ancient barrier reef, teeming with life. In fact, it stretched about 1,400 kilometres from Kununurra around the Kimberley coast, coming in through Derby and ending almost at Halls Creek.
How did you find it?
Well, Go-Go was a site discovered actually by Kurt Tykert in the 1940s, a great German paleontologist, and collected by the British Museum working with Australian parties in the 1960s. But I started my career there, Robin, in 1986 when I moved to Western Australia and decided it was a site with magnificent three-dimensionally preserved fish fossils and I wanted to go and collect from there.
And these are Devonian, aren't they? 400 million years, roughly.
Yes,
like that?
Yes. I mean, the reef goes back 400 million years sort of thing. It's 380, 375 million years old is the age of the Go-Go fishes. And why they're so special is simply because they occur in these nodules of limestone, and inside them is a whole uncrushed perfect fish. And using weak acetic acid, we slowly bubble away, get rid of that limestone, and the bones poke out, pristine and white. And eventually, by hardening the bones and getting rid of more of the rock, we completely free a skeleton out of the rock. And it's like the skeleton of a living fish. It's just like it died yesterday.
And by the hundred, I suppose.
Well, we've got quite a few of these fish. And it's also the most diverse fauna of its age anywhere in the world. So it's not just one or two species. We're talking about 45 different species of ancient fish.
And this area where you're actually looking for fossils, is that a cattle station, a farm at the moment?
Yes. Well, Go-Go Station is a 1.3 million hectare large cattle station, and adjacent properties to that also contain fossil sites. So it's a large area to span and search, and it's not easy to find the fossils, which is one of the good things that actually protects them from, unscrupulous collection, because it is hard work to find a single fish. And you need to actually go out there with a team of people that know what they're doing and spend a lot of time searching to find some good specimens.
What I love about your book, apart from the fact that you're standing there proudly holding your skeletons and lumps of stone, is the skulls of the fish. They look so heavy, robust.
Yes, well, it's from a time when fishes were emerging as the dominant life on Earth. And for 70 million years before the first amphibians walked on land at the end of the Devonian, fishes were the lords of the vertebrate world. They lived in the seas, the rivers, the lakes. And these particular fish have a special story to tell about evolution, because within the Go-Go fish, with such perfect preservation, and I'm not just talking beautifully preserved skulls and brain cases, I'm talking we've recently obtained phosphatized muscle, nerve cells and even capillaries in a Go-Go fish. And we published this earlier this year in Biology Letters, actually. So it is remarkably the world's best preservation of any sort of fossil of this age.
So this is soft tissue somehow preserved?
Phosphatized, yes, microbially replaced. As the little microbes eat up the soft tissue, they precipitate minerals in their place that make a ghost relic of what that soft tissue was like.
Yeah, so you can actually get the form without actually having the tissue itself.
We actually identified Kate Trinajstic in West Australia, one of my ex-students did this work with me and a team of others, isolated muscle bundles with the nerves still attached to the centre of the muscles. and the axial plate of the neuron.
Isn't that incredible?
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, because I know that in the United States they do still have soft tissue somehow from dinosaurs, which
they do indeed, yes.
Which is just remarkable. Michigan, yeah. One of the people from the University of Michigan. Now, is it the case that GoGo is not, as it might seem, a kind of enthusiastic Western go-for-it name, but in fact an Aboriginal name?
That's correct, Robin. It took me a long time to find the origin of the name, but I believe it was an Aboriginal stockman back at the turn of the century, last century, when they were just opening up the land for cattle farming. And then the station was called GoGo Station, and we call the GoGo Formation is the rock unit where the fossils come from.
Tell me, how do you compare this site, the GoGo site, so far away from Canoundra, which of course is where the Fish Museum is, and they're another wonderful deposit?
Yeah. Well, Canoundra is a very special deposit, and it is wonderful in terms of it's got whole, complete, big fish. And the sorts of fishes that we're intrinsically interested in, the story about the origin of fishes to land animals. But GoGo is really, the preservation is so much better. It's real bone at GoGo. It's three-dimensional. It's uncrushed. And there's no ambiguity when you're interpreting a skull from GoGo compared to something that's just a latex peel is how you study the material. So GoGo gives us a different level of clarity, I think, on interpreting these fossils. But both of those sites contribute to this one big question about how did fish evolve into land animals. And late last year, we had a paper published in Nature that actually showed a GoGo fish that had big holes in the top of its head. And we believe these spiracles, which are identified in other fish, were actually connected to the inner ear. And it shows the sort of the origin of the eustachian tube going from fish to land animals when
My eustachian tube at the back of my throat, actually, if I swallow, you know, if I've just been in a plane and things are blocked off, you swallow and you can feel it go pop.
Yes,
that's the eustachian tube.
That's the one, and it's got this function with hearing and also balance. The other thing we found on this GoGo fish that was only discovered in 2005 of a fish called GoGonasis, meaning snout from GoGo, is that it had a humerus, ulna and a radius, the same three bones in our human arm, which we've known before that some of these fish have these bones, but never before had we had a three-dimensional arm of a fish prepared out of a rock. And it showed that they were far more advanced than we'd ever dreamed about, that they're actually more elongate, more tetrapod-like than we'd expect for a fish like this. So here we have a fish way back 380 million years that's got the origins of the human body plan in it, and that's why it's exciting.
Yes, we'll come to that in your other book, which was published, or republished, if you like, just recently as well. Now, you've had the most extraordinary year. Last time I talked to you was in Western Australia, and you'd just crawled out of a cave in the Nullarbor where you'd come across Thylacoleo, several of the marsupial lions, as well as various new species of kangaroo. And that's just been published as well, isn't it?
Yes. As you know, I left Western Australia back in 2004 to take up my position in Museum Victoria, and I turned over that project to Gavin Prideaux, who's now running with it and leading the project. And he coordinated a team of us, including myself, to write that up and publish it in Nature earlier this year. And the results really were spectacular, because it wasn't just this great diversity of animals like marsupial lions and big kangaroos and giant wombat type things, but it was the fact that the team did a great analysis of the isotopes of the enamel of the teeth and could show that these animals compared with modern animals, mammals that lived in arid environments. So what we're saying is, if we look at the ice ages in the last 2 million years, of which we've gone through a cycle of seven ice ages, these animals were already adapted to aridity and they wouldn't have been affected by such big climate swings. So it really was a sort of a very compelling piece of evidence that maybe humans were the main factor in wiping out the megafauna.
Yeah, we'll come to that, but remember, if you're watching at home, Catalyst, we actually saw John Long going down into the cave. Pretty big cave, but would you describe it again in case?
Yes, I mean, it was, to me, it was the most spectacular find I've ever been involved with as a paleontologist, and the most exciting field trip, you know, one could go on. We drop down these caves, which open up as small holes about a metre across, drop down about 18 metres, you abseil down, and you're into these vast chambers. Some of them are almost the size of football fields. And then by looking around with torches, we find bones and skeletons scattered around these various caves. If it wasn't for the help of the amateur cavers who found the site and the various people and teams that contributed, we wouldn't have found so many specimens. But in the end, something like 60 complete skeletons of megafauna were retrieved out of those three caves over 3 years.
How many marsupial lions?
probably about 11, I think. 8 more or less articulated and relatively complete, and 3 partial skeletons.
And is the idea that these animals fell down the hole because they were wandering around, presumably on the Nullarbor Plain, and boom,
absolutely,
there's a hole and clunk?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be a very big hole, but an animal only has to fall down about once every 100 years. And over tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, you can get a large accumulation. But we think these pit traps were probably only operational for short periods of time to preserve a window or a snapshot of what was living up there. And then they were sort of blocked up. And that fact that they were blocked up, not letting any other sort of material in the cave, that kept them so pristine and undisturbed.
And what makes you think, having discovered them like that, that it was human beings that knocked them off? Is it that they suddenly stopped falling into the hole?
No. These animals actually have been dated a much older sort of dates. We're talking about 400,000 to 800,000 years. So humans probably came into the country around 60,000 to 50,000 years ago. So we don't think this deposit has any direct relevance to people coming into the country. But what we're saying is the analysis of the teeth showed that they were adapted to a kind of aridity that then was already pervasive on the Nullarbor Plain. Now, by having such a large number of herbivores there, like 23 species of kangaroo, we know that there's probably a larger diversity of flora, many more shrubs and plants there than today, even though the aridity might have been quite similar. Once people come into the country and start burning off, then a few waves of burning basically clears out the non-fire-resistant plants, and all you're left with after that are the fire-resistant chenopod scrub, and that's today what dominates the Nullarbor. So that's one piece of evidence, but the other compelling evidence, if you look at the timing when people came into Australia about 60 to 50,000 years ago, there weren't any dramatic shifts in climate. It was between a bigger ice age back 200,000 years ago and one that was going to happen at 18,000 years ago. But the climate at that point was particularly mild, so there wouldn't have been any reason to suspect climate change as a factor.
With all this evidence mounting up, why is there still a dispute about whether humans killed the megafauna?
Well, the main dispute comes back to the dating or the timing of when the megafauna was extinct. There was a paper by Bert Roberts and Tim Flannery and a bunch of others in 2001 published in Science that analysed some 30-odd sites around Australia where articulated megafauna was found with grains of sand intact between those bones, indicating the material wasn't reworked. And they, using the optical stimulation luminescence method, came up with a 95% confidence level of 46,000 years for the extinction of the megafauna. And that's a mathematical, statistical conclusion that most people would accept. Similar work from other sites more or less backs that up, work by Gifford Miller looking at the extinction of giant birds, Genyornis, in the central Australian basins. 50,000 years, they die out suddenly. So two compelling bits of evidence that say the megafauna suddenly drops off the face of the earth, in Australia at least, about 46 to 50,000 years ago. The other people that argue that climate change was a factor, and of course it could have been a major factor, would have to really pin their argument on the megafauna surviving to 18,000 years ago and then being wiped out, because that was the peak of the last aridity. And there just isn't the dates to show we have any megafauna conclusively younger than or in that zone between 18,000 and 45,000.
Yes, indeed. Now, you mentioned earlier that you'd come across to Melbourne and marvellous new museum, wonderfully furnished. And I can't help noticing that around the country, say in Queensland and in WA, the number of vertebrate paleontologists is getting smaller and smaller. With all these treasures, how is Australia coping with their exploration?
I think it's really sad, Robin, that, you know, 10 years ago we would have had at least double the number of vertebrate paleontologists employed in Australia in permanent positions. And most of them are employed in museums, because most of the university positions tend to be zoology positions or geology positions where they teach paleontology or do other things and can't devote, you know, all that time to just looking after vertebrate fossils. I don't know. It is sad, and it really disappoints me that a lot of these positions just haven't been replaced. The loss of positions at the Australian Museum in particular in Sydney. The West Australian Museum hasn't replaced my position after 2 years, even though they had Gavin Prideaux working on another contract paid for by another sort of fund. Queensland does have a vertebrate paleontologist, and he was young Australian of the year, young Scotty Hucknall. So he's still up there. But it is sad. There are a number of other positions that have been lost. Tasmania's another one, doesn't have a vertebrate paleontology position.
Well, what do people say in museums, that deep time doesn't matter, that these fossils we've been talking about, which are unbelievably important, have been discovered, or that we can't afford to...
I think people are robbing themselves of a very important philosophical view of life by not having this expertise around. For a start, vertebrate paleontology may not be that economically valuable to industry, but it's a huge driver of media and entertainment, and there'll always need to be specialist input into those fields. The number of us that have, including, you know, your good colleague and mine, Paul Willis, who's now a science reporter.
And Catalyst.
Has a vertebrate paleontology background, and that got him into the media. I think there's always going to be a role for people to comment in the media and the entertainment world, but more importantly, to give us that deeper perspective from their discoveries. I mean, you know, the place of humanity in nature, that's what we're looking at, and that's the big question.
Well, I wonder, in science in general, one of the most expensive things is astronomy, because you need telescopes and you need computers to run these. But to do your job, as you can see from your book, The Go-Go Book, well, okay, you need to be on location with a hammer and a chisel.
And a hat.
You don't need much more than that, do you?
Well, that's the basic level that you can go out and make a big discovery. I mean, we were up there like a year and a half ago, up there at Gogo with a hammer and a chisel and a hat, hit a rock and bang, we've made a discovery that then made Nature magazine and was on, you know, all throughout the world's media. And it's relatively easy to do that in paleontology if you keep working hard at sites. I mean, you know, one of my mentors, Tom Rich, here at Museum Victoria, spent 25 years looking for prehistoric mammals in the Cretaceous rocks of Victoria, finally found one in 1997. Now he's got about 30 of them, about half a dozen different kinds, and he's rewriting the story of the earliest mammals known from Australia. So it's that sort of persistence that one has to have.
When you go to your ex-bosses, either in Western Australia or when you talk to people in New South Wales, and you ask them, why are these positions not being... What's their excuse? What's their justification?
A common one is that because of rises in salaries, to pay salary increases, they have to take the money from somewhere, and the governments just don't give them more money to replace those positions. So because of that, if someone like myself leaves and all of the staff get a pay rise, they have to take it from somewhere. It comes out of the same pot of money.
Just money.
It just gets absorbed.
So yeah. It's a few salaries we're talking about.
That's all we're talking about.
Yes.
And let me put an interesting point. I mean, if you look at the brilliant work that Tim Flannery did at the South Australian Museum, he got three or four new positions appointed when he started, and that took a bit of fighting, obviously, with the government to get that extra bit of money. Those people then brought in something like $3.2 million in ARC research grants over the next few years.
That's the research
council. So, I mean, getting productive scientists pays for themselves many times over in terms of the economic argument.
But in terms of intellectual heft and point, what you were saying before about the tracing of the jaws, the Eustachian tubes, the various things to do with those lovely fish, the argument we're having about unintelligent design... all sorts of things. No, that's the title of my book. It just slipped out.
Yes.
Intelligent Design, as they call it, which has taken over vast amounts of America. And it's seeped through to Western Europe, and it's had a certain rise here. You won't be able to show the evidence about how evolution actually worked. These supposed missing links, which, of course, people argue about whether there's a flow of evolution or whether you get a dramatic change. Well, those sorts of things are the very ones that you're finding in
Absolutely.
The field, the fossils.
Yeah.
And so you will never finish the argument unless you finish your work as paleontologists.
Well, it's a fine line where you draw a missing link. I mean, I would argue now that since Darwin's day, we have over a million-fold more fossils in museums around the world, something like a billion specimens you could count. You know, there's 3 or 4 million specimens in our museum alone of fossils. So when you add it all up, we've got all the major steps we need to know in terms of the major steps of vertebrate evolution. Going from dinosaurs to birds is a classic one. You know, in the last 10 years, there's been a wave of new specimens from China with everything you could possibly want, from small feathered dinosaurs to small feathered dinosaurs with bigger arms to small feathered dinosaurs with bigger arms and pinaceous feathers to birds. And so the amount of data coming out of the paleontological record is just overwhelming. What I would say to these intelligent design people is you don't need design, you just look at the fossils, because it's a pattern, and it's like the emperor's new clothes. If you showed a little kid that knew nothing about science the stages between a dinosaur and a bird, he would see the link and he would see the evolutionary pattern continue. What I'm trying to do with the go-go stuff is simply take the human body plan and push that pattern right back and see where parts of that pattern originate. And the human body is like a town, you know. It's got houses, it's got parts that are old, it's got parts that are new, but all of them have a history and an origin. And so instead of looking at evolution from going from one animal to another, I've taken a fresh new perspective and I'm looking at the origin of body parts and how they fit in, where they originate. So the same two bones that make up the top of our head, the parietal and frontal, go back to our Devonian fish. You can trace them right back.
How wonderful. You've had a fantastic year. Of course, two books, as we've said, and two publications in the journal Nature. What next for John Long?
Well, I'm very pleased that, you know, things are just running well in terms of the lab and my team at Museum Victoria. I've got a great team there, and I'm working with the ANU team doing ultrafine CT scanning of our fossils, Tim Senden up there and Gavin Young. We just got another big ARC discovery grant in the last round, so it's all gung-ho to do more and more of this same sort of work and hopefully find more of the origins of the human body plan.
Any children's books?
Yes, I've always got a couple on the go. In fact, I'm doing one with the West Australian Museum on Leo the marsupial lion. So you can watch out for that one later this year.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Robin.
I'd say no more work for mine.
Welcome to the club.
On my door I'd hang a sign, gone fishing instead of just a wishing.
Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong, The Joys of Fishing. And before that, you heard Dr. John Long of the Museum of Victoria. His latest book is called Swimming in Stone, The Amazing Go-Go Fossils of the Kimberley, published by Fremantle Arts Centre Press. And I see it has a foreword from his cousin, Dr. Tim Flannery.
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. A biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys, you're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing instead of just a wishing.
Bapa, baby, bapa, bapa, bapa.
Oh, yeah.
Next week we dip into the past once more, this time as revealed by tree rings. I shall be in conversation with dendrochronologist Malcolm Hughes.
The ones that we're most directly exclusively engaged on are bristlecone pine, which are trees that can reach very, very great ages, up to almost 5,000 years, in the dry, high mountains of the interior American West. And their story is that they live somewhere where nobody else wants to live. If they lived in places where other plants wanted to live, there would be competitors. There would be enough dead stuff left for fire to be able to run through. And so not only do they live for a long time, when they die, their wood, which is very resinous, which means, of course, it would burn hot and spitty and nasty. But in fact, because the densities of vegetation are so low there, fire rarely carries through, and thus wood survives on the landscape. In fact, at some places, for most of the time since the end of the last ice age. So we have wood over most of the last 11,000 years at one particular location, not much bigger than a football field. Of course, a lot of that wood is relict wood lying on the landscape, but even that, we're very careful about it because it's clearly an important natural resource. The living trees we core with a tool called an increment corer, a little more than a centimeter in diameter. We take out a long, thin pencil of wood that's 4 or 5 millimeters in diameter, and that will yield, depending on how fast the tree is growing, some hundreds or some thousands of years.
Malcolm Hughes is Professor of Dendrochronology at the University of Arizona. And coming up at 8 o'clock, if you're listening on Thursday evening, you can see the aforementioned paleontologist-turned-sex object, Dr. Paul Willis, in the second part of his exploration of sex and success in business. That's on ABC Television on Catalyst. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.